Our honoree, the man I am truly honored to introduce tonight, the man who reminds us that there was once a time when an American could receive the Nobel Peace Prize and actually deserve it, Dr. Henry Kissinger. When Rob and Roger Hertog called me, they asked me if I'd be willing to give a 7-minute introduction for Henry Kissinger. And I said yes, but actually what I thought was, that's a ridiculous amount of time. This is a man who needs no introduction, or at most 15 seconds, and it would go like this. Henry Kissinger is the finest practitioner of statecraft of the last half century, and he is also the finest foreign policy thinker of our time. End of story, QED. But I owe Roger and Rob 6 minutes. So I will bring you along on an exercise in redundancy in which I elaborate on these two more than obvious propositions. When Henry Kissinger was in office, he achieved, among other things, 3 remarkable achievements. The first and the most underappreciated is that he negotiated a tactical withdrawal from the Vietnam War. We all know that every general says that retreat is the most difficult of all maneuvers militarily. And yet Kissinger brought us to the verge of salvaging an honorable peace before that remarkable achievement was undone by domestic politics. The second achievement, we all know, was the breakthrough with China. But what I think is underappreciated is how much that was an act of sheer, pure diplomacy. Most geopolitical realignments happen either in conjunction with or as a result of military or economic force majeure, such as the post-war Atlantic Alliance. But Kissinger and Nixon fashioned the China opening out of thin air. It was the purest of pure diplomacy, an act of extraordinary imagination, beginning an extraordinary strategy brought to fruition by extraordinary tactical execution and turning it into the most important geopolitical realignment of the Cold War era. And the third achievement, the one that is most relevant to our proceedings here tonight and to the Washington Institute, is the shuttle diplomacy that lay the groundwork for Arab-Israeli peace. To me, this is the most interesting because it is the most complicated and the most intellectually demanding, which brings me to the other aspect of Henry Kissinger that I mentioned earlier, his prominence as the great foreign policy thinker of our time. Henry Kissinger is the quintessential American realist, but with a deep understanding of the limits of classical realism, especially in the American context. Realism, classical European realism, the realism of Hans Morgenthau, who defined interest as power, must accommodate and incorporate 2 American realities: public opinion and American exceptionalism, which themselves are intertwined because policy must be conducted within the limits of public opinion, and yet public opinion itself powerfully carries and insists upon America's unique mission in the world. The tension between realism and American idealism has always been most acute in dealing with Israel and the Middle East, going all the way back to Truman's dispute with Marshall over the recognition of Israel and continuing today with Mearsheimer and Walt and the view of some decidedly anti-Zionist realists that Israel is a strategic liability that should long ago have been cut loose by the United States. Henry Kissinger always rejected that view, and his rejection has been critical in the intellectual combat over U.S.-Israeli relations. And for Henry, the idea of Israel as a strategic asset is more than theoretical. After all, it was Henry Kissinger who was at the center of the crisis in September 1970, when Syria invaded Jordan and threatened the existence of the Hashemite kingdom. And Henry picked up the phone and called Yitzhak Rabin out of a function much like this one, in a hotel like this one in New York. And together they fashioned a response that involved Israeli reconnaissance over the Syrian invasion, the threat of an Israeli aerial attack, and even a ground operation, which in conjunction with other measures that Henry undertook resulted in a Syrian withdrawal and the survival of an important ally in the Middle East, King Hussein's of Jordan. That event demonstrated once and for all, and for many skeptics, the extraordinary strategic advantage to the United States of having at the center of the Middle East a permanent and reliable and powerful American ally in the form of Israel. A few years later, after the Yom Kippur War, Henry Kissinger went on to astonishing success in not only harmonizing U.S. strategic interests with a fundamental commitment to the protection and survival of Israel after the Yom Kippur War, but he brilliantly maximized both, at once putting Israel on a course to its first true negotiations, recognition, and ultimately peace with Arab states, while at the same time turning around the single most important Arab state and turning it from a Soviet client into an American ally, Sadat's Egypt. Both of these achievements continue to this day and remain the foundation of the Middle East efforts of every Secretary of State who has succeeded him. It's been over 30 years since Henry Kissinger left office. Most Americans today have only a vague memory of the Cold War, the vaguest recollection of the Soviet Union, and would have trouble naming any of the last eight secretaries of state, but not the ninth. What was the most animated exchange in the presidential debate between Obama and McCain only 10 days ago? It was, with whom did Henry Kissinger side in their argument over diplomacy with Iran? McCain and Barack Obama are not the only ones who measure themselves against Kissinger's ideas and policies. Whenever I write about the foreign affairs, I'm always thinking, whether consciously or unconsciously, what would Henry do? I suppose this is the Jewish counterpart of what would Jesus do? A comparison that I think Henry would find both congenial and apt. Ladies and gentlemen, I have the honor of introducing Dr. Henry Kissinger.
Whoops.